Good morning, diners and travelers. You're listening to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig. And today we bring to you, for your consideration, three stories of that good old American ingenuity.
Yeah, I'm not sure I can call it Yankee ingenuity. Two out of the three are. The third, I'm not sure. Because he's now in California, so I guess you're never really very sure. And we're going to lead off with Ryan Farr. Farr,
exactly.
Not near, Farr. Who's something of a genius with meat, which these days seems kind of an unpopular part of the diet, except around here where we really love it.
Well, he's also a genius with butchering.
Yeah, and we especially love sausages.
And sausages.
At least I do, which Ryan makes some very splendid ones.
Yes, we had some of his.
It's a big story in California, and we wish we were in San Francisco so we could sidle down to the ferry market every week and get more.
Yeah, but you can, because he's produced two books now, one called Whole Animal Butchery and the second called Sausage Making, which should enable you to follow directions and make your own sausage.
And even if you can't do that, you can always buy it through the internet.
So. Exactly.
So anyway, here's Ryan, who turns out was a fascinating guy with a rather challenging situation for doing the interview, because he was sitting in his car, stopped at the side of the road with his two children in the back playing Angry Birds. So here's Ryan Farr, despite the Angry Birds going on in the background. So now we know why Angry Birds are so angry. They even interfered with our interview with Ryan Farr, who's out there in California taking care of his children when he's not running a butcher shop. It turns out there are some pigs in Angry Birds. I didn't even know that.
Oh, yes. Yeah. That's the whole point.
Oh, yeah.
So the Angry Birds knocked over this conversation, but we started over again. But there are pigs in here somewhere too, right, Ryan?
Yes, sir. Yeah.
Should we start all over? Or
we already started over.
Oh, we started over.
We had what you might call an unconventional beginning.
Now you
had a rather conventional start in the food business. You were a chef at a Michelin-starred restaurant, which was called, by the way?
Fifth Floor.
Oh, right. Okay. We're very, very familiar. But we never got there, but it was supposed to be really good. It must have been that way till you left.
There's been a lot of amazing chefs. It's called Fifth. Past, present,
oh,
right. Future.
Yeah. What's her name was there? And Laura,
what's her name? We never forget
Melissa,
what's her name.
Melissa Perella. Melissa Perella. So I worked with the majority of the time there.
Yeah.
All right. She's the one who's at Francis now, right?
That's correct.
Yes,
yeah.
Exactly.
Okay. She's great. For over 3 years.
But you decided that pigging it out in the restaurant terms was not the right thing to do. So how did this, I guess what you might call it, Saul of Tarsus kind of moment happen?
I wanted to do something new and was working for a nonprofit, and I had a difficulty, you know, paying the bills. And so I started selling pork rinds or chicharrones and making hot dogs and doing butcher classes. And so the company just formed it from necessity, and that's where we're at today, and
let me backtrack just a little bit now. Just make sure that everybody got your name, Ryan Farr, F-A-R-R. The name of your company is 4505 Meats. It's a real live butcher shop in San Francisco. And many, many more things which you're going to tell us about in the process. And I want to mention these chicharrones that I couldn't believe that they were so light. They were just absolutely blew my mind. How do you do that?
Secret. A lot of love. A lot of love goes in.
I've never tasted anything like it.
A lot of love went into eating them too, but they sure didn't last very long.
I ate a lot of them.
Yeah, they go pretty quick.
Yeah, you don't feel like you've had anything to eat because they're so airy.
Yeah.
Anyhow.
Yeah, that's pretty good.
So let's take, I mean, you're also an author, and I want to get to that too, but, and a teacher. Let's start with, besides the chicharrones, what all do you sell in your shop? And it's called 4505 Meats, right?
Yes, ma'am. We do, at the butcher shop, is pretty much all whole animal butchery. And so we process the beef, pigs, lambs, goats, rabbits, chickens, everything ourselves, and then we make sausages from what's left over after we remove, you know, the prime cuts, like steaks, pork chops, and, you know, treat crudes. So we do a lot of classical preparations and do a lot of smoking, smoke a lot of bacon.
And you do grass-fed beef that people rave about, your ground beef too, huh?
Yeah, we do. We sell a lot of ground beef, a lot of grass-fed ground beef. We deal with some, been buying from some amazing ranchers for 5 years now, and it's a great relationship. Love the support they give us, and we love supporting them.
Okay, now your first cookbook was called Whole Beast Butchery, right?
Correct, yeah.
Okay,
yeah,
and then just before we get off that subject, certain things you can actually order online from you.
We sell just direct as well online, books and other merchandise and stuff as well.
But you make a variety of different sausages, some not very mainstream sort of combinations.
Creative.
Why are they this way? Is it just that certain animals have more leftovers than others, or you have a preference?
I think how we look at sausage, the company, is we don't look at it as regional names. We look at them as flavors and textures. And that's how we decide what type of sausage we're going to be making is based on the texture. Like if we wanted something smooth, something soft, or something firm. And that's really kind of going directly about the book, how we break down each chapter in the book is broken up by the texture.
Okay.
So like a hot dog is going to be a different texture than a breakfast sausage. You know, hot dog is smooth, breakfast sausage is crumbly.
Give us the name of that book so people who want to find out.
Oh,
about this.
Yes, Sausage Making.
Okay, and it's a DIY sausage-making book. Tells you everything, right?
Yes. Yes, ma'am.
Everything in detail so the people who get that book can read it and actually make their own sausages.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
Okay. And we forgot to list your website for the ordering of what's on your website.
Yeah.
What's the URL?
4505meats.com.
Now, what's the significance of 4505? Because that's not your street address, right?
Correct. No, it is an address, and it's a dedication and tribute to a fellow friend and chef that passed away. So it's a celebration of his life. And my wife and I, when we started the company, we wanted to have something that was meaningful to us and the folks in the city, in our group. And it was kind of hard because all we were coming up with was porky puffs and pig farts. So we were all we had with the chicharrones at the time. And so it was made sense. And we really love it, and it's an honor. So.
There you go. Now, people can also, they can find you in person in the Mission District, but you also make it easy for them by going to some farmers markets in the San Francisco area, one of them being very accessible, right?
Yeah, we're at the Ferry Building Plaza, Ferry
we
Plaza
love,
Farmers
we
Market.
Absolutely
San
love
Francisco.
The Ferry Plaza, yeah.
Yeah, on Saturdays and Thursdays, and then we're actually also opening up a restaurant at the end of next month.
Yeah, now tell us about that.
That's something we're just, it's the food that we do, or the fare that we do at the farmers markets, and burgers and barbecue, that's the two things that we do a lot of. And so we're now just going to be able to have a spot where you can find us 7 days a week, opposed to the hall and coolers around and full of ice a couple days a week. So we're really, really excited about it.
And
beautiful
what's the
area.
Thing called?
It's going to be called 4505 Burgers and Barbecue.
Oh, okay. And Peter is English, and he's the sausage expert. So he has some comments on your sausage.
Yeah, it's interesting. We had Irish bangers as made by Whole Foods for lunch today, which are extremely good. And they're a very spicy recipe, but the interesting ingredient that most Americans would object to if they knew it was in there is that there's quite a lot of cereal in there, but really that's one of the things that makes a sausage a sausage.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. It's all about, you know, putting in everything that you have, you know, left over and really trying to make sure that we really try to concentrate as much as possible on technique and therefore whatever we do put in there tastes good and have good texture.
Yeah, Peter commented on the texture.
Yeah, I wanted to tell you a sausage story, if you will, and then branch out into my question because it's the reason for the question. Our cousin Richard lives in a small town in Tasmania off the coast of Australia, and whenever we go, he always serves beef sausages, which he buys from a local butcher who makes them himself, but you're not allowed to prick them. So the butcher says, if you're going to prick these sausages, I won't sell them to you.
We don't prick.
And I was explaining to Anne that this had something to do with his pride in the content of the offal tube, because what's in there is very little fat, hence the no necessity to prick them to let the fat escape. Now, I notice that the whole food sausages do require pricking, otherwise they will be like bangers and they will bang.
That's why it's called bangers.
Yeah, exactly.
But I noticed that your sausages also were very dense, and I was particularly impressed. The chicken sausages were so firm, because chicken's really a hard sort of, it's kind of a sloppy wet meat to deal with. So what are you doing that's different? Are you aiming for this really stuffed feeling? Is that part of the process that you think's important?
Yeah, absolutely. It's a lot about the process, and that's kind of the main thing. It's really basic rules we follow. We try to keep the meat as cold as possible. Whenever we use the meat grinder, we want to make sure that the blades are as sharp as possible, and we just take our time and go nice and slow with it to make sure that the juice and the fats and everything is blended together nicely so that it's married nice and plump. And it really comes down to the simple technique of making sausage. That's kind of the thing. It's a simple thing that ends up being kind of the hard thing, though.
But what you're doing is you're eliminating unnecessary liquid ingredient from the process.
Correct. Okay. Correct.
Now, well, I had a question about the casing. What do you use for casings?
Well, we use hog casing and we use sheep casing, all natural casings.
Okay, that's what I thought. That's what I told Peter.
Yeah. Yeah, we don't prick either. If you do a good job of mixing and you cook nice and gently and slow, there's no need to prick, and you start cooking fast is when you burn something and it explodes, and so we do not recommend pricking.
Okay.
Unless there's an air pocket during the creating of the process, we do not prick that. But.
So you believe in my cousin's Richard Butcher's version
Absolutely.
Of the story?
Yeah, okay. Richard. Sounds like you know what you're talking about.
You give us some ideas of your unusual flavor combinations in the sausages, because you don't ship all of them, do you?
No, ma'am.
No, tell us the range that you have.
We have the books coming out, so we have all of our recipes in there, and we have even more recipes that we do all the time that didn't make it into the book. But we're doing one sausage a week out of our shop, and we're basically pretty much going to have you doing a sausage out of the book for the next year. There's plenty of recipes in there. And the whole thing about the book and why it's unique to other type of books out there, I mean, it's the book that I wish I had when I was learning to make sausage, is each texture has a master ratio of water, fat, protein, and salt. And so if you follow that master ratio, you really can add any flavors you want. So it's really helpful if you wanted to make a coarse sausage. You just follow this master ratio, and then if you wanted to put chili flake in there, or fennel, or pine, or bacon, or whatever. So it really kind of breaks it down to a really simple way of looking at sausage.
You know, my mother always made her own sausage until I found a good butcher. So I was raised on that. And we used to, it was a big project because you had to grind your own meat. She had her own little blend of it. Pork to beef to something or other. And then she had, after grinding it, then she had this funnel that got attached onto the tube, the casing tube, and then you pushed everything by hand into the sausage casing and then tied it off. You took forever.
it's something not to take for granted, but it's definitely worth it. Labor of love, but when you have a beautiful sausage, so tasty and got good snap to it, nothing better than that.
Well, a couple of San Francisco's most iconic modern chefs, Michael Tusk and Daniel Patterson, both swear by your book. So they must be eating something other than the fine food that they cook for the rest of the world. Do they come by and buy for themselves, or?
Oh yeah, Daniel comes to this farmer's market all the time and gets a cheeseburger or picks up some sausage. So we're really fortunate to be in San Francisco and to be in a town or just anywhere where people love good food. It's a great thing.
And very market is wonderful. Now, is Boca Lone a competitor or will be a competitor of yours?
I guess we do kind of, we don't really sell the same product. They do more of salamis, and they do have some sausages, but it's a really small city, and we're all friends.
Well, he closed Encanto, hasn't he? Chris Cardinale.
Yeah, they're doing a new concept with that, which is just really
Boccalone.
Exciting.
Yeah. With Boccalone. But, yeah.
But anyhow, yeah, Chris is great.
He is fabulous. I love him. So, well, when you're seeing all your other fellow vendors, say hello also to Michael Ricciuti for us.
Yeah, you will. Absolutely.
I miss being there.
it's a great place.
Oh, yeah. But honestly, Brian, it's great talking to you. And I can't wait to start making sausages again.
Well, you got to come out and we do it together.
Okay.
Hey, that would be fun.
Yes, absolutely. Thank you.
Thank you so much. And pinch those two little cherubs for me.
I will. You got it.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
And we should note, by the way, although we did not have his wife on the phone, Cecily is co-founder and major supporter of this operation,
4505 Beats. There you go. So they're in it together, and I'm guessing that he's got another generation that's there, too, because they're shooting angry birds at pigs. So they can slaughter them to make sausages. Seriously, folks, it's time to take a break, and right after that, we'll be right back with another interesting story.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back, and next up, we're going to invite you to listen to a discussion we had with one of my favorite great heroes, Alison Hooper, who pretty much carved out this mountain of successes for American cheese through VermontCreamery.com.
The companies had a variety of different names, some of which were very confusing. We talked to Alison a few years ago, and they were still struggling with the fact that they had a name that conflicted with somebody else, but they managed to simplify it. But they certainly didn't simplify what they're doing at the Vermont Creamery, because they're making still even more outstanding cheeses, which we've been enjoying.
And butter, which is what I'm consuming by
the
There
you go,
yeah.
Right,
yeah.
So this is actually an article more about
cultured butter
than it is anything else, but sitting on the table where we're in the recording studio is a reminder of a fascinating cheese they make at Vermont Creamery called Double Cream Cremant, which is made with aged goat and cow's milk mixed up together, handmade in Vermont.
Well, she talks about this. Let's listen to Alison Hooper. It's been a while since we talked to Alison Hooper. I always get excited at the prospect, Alison, because you've always been at the forefront of the cheese movement in America and actually in the whole world, and dairy products in general. Just to refresh our listeners' minds, you started Vermont Creamery when?
Well, actually, we're celebrating our 30th anniversary this year. We started in 1984,
wow.
And back then we were called Vermont Butter and Cheese Company, and we've evolved to be able to simplify the name a bit and make it more memorable to Vermont Creamery.
Okay, well then that helps me a lot, because I was getting confused about what was the appropriate terminology.
I'm sure you're not the only one, so.
Okay, so you had what? You had a farm?
Well, actually, Bob Reese and I started the business, and we're still business partners, and we didn't have a farm. My husband had a farm, and Bob and I set up our cheese making on the milk house at the farm, and it was about a 10x10 milk house that used to be the milking parlor for milking goats, and we renovated it to pasteurize milk and make cheese. Today we're in a building which is a kind of a state-of-the-art creamery in an industrial park with lots of water, and we're expanding all the time, but still remain a pretty small company, actually.
Well, now, you started winning awards with your cheese, which got everybody's attention, because American cheese was not actually taken seriously in all these European competitions, right?
That's right. You remember in the early years when we said we were making French-style cheeses, anybody who knew good cheese would admonish that, you know, only good cheese comes from Europe and the Americans should stick with doing something else. And over the decades, as the Americans had to prove ourselves, I guess, we really get very focused on artisanal cheese and very high quality cheese. And today, yeah, we're winning awards along with the best of them. So it's great.
Now, do you do exclusively goat?
No, half of our business is goat milk, and we make a fresh chèvre and some aged goat cheeses. And then half the business is cow's milk and cream primarily, and we make cream-based products like creme fraiche and mascarpone and cultured butter.
And you also make double cream cremant.
Aged
goat and cow. You don't breed the goats with the cows. You just
No, we haven't figured that out yet. No.
but you do mix up the milk, and it's really rather delicious.
Yeah.
Before we came on there, I had a piece that I had cut carefully to mature for about an hour and a half to come to room temperature, and I was going down to eat it just before this interview, and I noticed that quite a large mouthful had been consumed. There must be a little mouse
in
this house.
It was a little mouthful.
Little mouse called Anne.
Well, you know, it was a fun cheese. We had started making the little aged goat cheeses have these very distinctive wrinkled rinds, and very much in the French style. And I felt like we needed something that was more approachable and easier for people to sell. And so we thought, well, let's make a double cream because everybody loves cream.
Yes.
And so let's blend the goat and the cow and add some cream. And it just turned out, it was really an instant hit. It's a wonderful, nice, creamy cheese.
Well, now, what happened already? This shipment of cheese arrived late last week. The goat cheese, the one with the slightly ashy-colored exterior,
yep.
that disappeared first. That didn't last very long at all.
Yeah.
That was equally delicious.
That's great. Well, you know, if people ask me, they say, now, this is a 4-ounce cheese, and what if I don't eat it all at once? And I say, well, you're probably not going to have a huge problem with this cheese hanging around in your refrigerator for that long. So
I think it made its way through three helpings, and then it was gone.
Yeah.
But the good news is there's a little log of traditional chèvre that's behind it, and then there's another little jar of like a spread.
Yep. You have a little, it's like an advent calendar. You have something to look forward to every day, right?
There you go. Well, no, the spready one, is that, I won't say real cheese, it is real cheese, but it's cheese with some flavors added.
Some flavors added, yeah. I think that what we find is, it's interesting, Americans like cheese with flavorings to spread on crackers, and so we're happy to give them what they like. And goat cheese goes so well with ingredients like olives and the roasted red peppers, you know, those very sort of Mediterranean kinds of foods, herbs and olive oil and such, that it's a great way to get Americans to eat goat cheese, even if they haven't for the first time. So.
Well, they have this thing in the South that our kids moved there into South Carolina, and I never had been exposed to this, an avalanche of pimento cheese.
Yeah. we don't have to talk about unpleasant subjects
like that.
But
that's why I'm a purist about flavorings.
The main reason Allison's on the program today is to talk about something that I don't. This is Peter. That I absolutely just don't understand. I understand butter.
Yeah.
But I don't understand cultured butter. So
right.
Take that ball and run with it.
Right. What on earth is that?
Right.
Well, cultured butter, by definition, is butter that is made with cultured cream. And cultured cream is a fermented cream. And so when you are in the supermarket and you have the choice of buying imported butters typically all of the imported butters are made with cultured cream. They're cultured butter.
Oh, I didn't know that. Okay, so if I'm eating English butter or French butter.
No,
right.
But Kerrygold is not cultured, is it?
It is. Yep, Kerrygold would be
really?
A cultured butter. Yep,
huh.
Yep. And so in our company, I had learned to make this butter on a farm in France, and actually we used raw cream, so it was naturally cultured, but it resulted in such a flavorful, wonderful, delicious butter. It was really didn't, you wanted to eat it by itself on a piece of bread, and that was it. And thought, gosh, if we could make this in the United States, people would really go back to eating butter and maybe not eat as much of it, but really recognize it's just a wonderful part of the diet. So we started to make the cultured butter by pasteurizing the cream, which
yeah,
we have to do.
Yeah, that's what I was going to ask you. I mean, you
we
have
to
do
that. And then we add a selected cultures back into the cream, and it ferments overnight, and where we ferment it at a nice low temperature for at least 10 hours, and it develops this wonderful, nutty, flavorful cream. It's like creme fraiche. And then, of course, we churn it, and you get this wonderful product. Not only is it cultured, but the butter fat of the cream that we use is higher than the butter fat in the cream that you use to make industrial butter. So the cream, the butter actually is 86% butter fat, and the butter that you typically buy in the supermarket is 80%. Consumers might think, oh, well, I'm not going to use a butter that's higher in fat. I'm already using all these fat calories just to eat the butter itself. But when you taste the difference, it's really quite remarkable. You think, well, if I'm actually going to spend my fat calories in this way, I really ought to spend them on something that's worthwhile and tastes really good.
Yeah, I ought to spend it on something that tastes really good, exactly.
Yeah.
Now this, you're doing this with cow's milk, but I'm getting the picture now. But the culturing only takes place over hours, unlike cheese where the cheese is aged for months or years.
Right. Typically in the cheesemaking, the part of the cheesemaking process that we call the culturing is very early on, and then of course once the cheese is made, whether it's a a large wheel or a small crottin, a little goat cheese, those cultures continue to ferment and metabolize over time.
Well, do you take and interrupt this process to, you said you produce creme fraiche, is
yes.
that the product you get after you've fermented the
cream.
Add the culture and fermented it overnight, and
yeah.
then do you have creme fraiche?
That's right.
And do you interrupt that process and sell that as it is?
Yeah, we do. The creme fraiche, when we first made the butter, we thought, well, we really have no idea what we're doing, which was really the Vermont Creamery way. A little bit of information was enough to get us into all kinds of trouble.
Mm-hmm.
So we put the creme fraiche into the churn and churned it into butter and thought, well, this tastes good. Let's find out from somebody who knows. And we sent it to a chef in New York, a French chef from Brittany, and I didn't know him and asked him to try it and tell me what he thought. And he was so thrilled. He said, you know, this is the butter of my childhood. I'm going to tell all my friends in New York to buy this.
Uh-huh.
But the process of making creme fraiche is slightly different from the butter, but it's a very similar idea. But you're right. With creme fraiche, all we're doing is pasteurizing that very high-fat cream and adding a bacterial culture and letting it sit overnight. And then it sets when it's on the cooler. After about a week, it gets firm and gets that nice, thick texture that we want.
Where do you get your cultures?
Cultures we buy from a French company, and they also have a company here in the United States. And when you make cheese or make cultured dairy products, you have the opportunity to select various strains of starter cultures that are going to produce a flavor profile that you're after, or they're going to produce, or they're very specific to the type of cheese that you're making. So it's.
I mean, for butter, what would you look for in a strain?
We want to use a culture that will survive and grow at a fairly low temperature, and it's called a lactic culture. And the flavor profile that we're looking for in butter making is called diacetyl, which it's actually, when we describe this diacetyl flavor, we think of hazelnut. And so in the fermentation process, the longer cream is fermented at this low temperature, each we get more and more flavor compounds in the fermentation process, and that's where you start to get that kind of nuttiness of a really good butter.
The higher the temperatures, it just makes it go faster and not as complex.
Exactly. A higher temperature is going to speed up the process, but it's also going to may produce some acidity in the flavor that you don't really want. So we're going to grow the acid at a low temperature and have it just take a little bit longer.
They know. It sounds like they know what they're doing.
Yeah, I think they do.
It took us 30 years to figure it out.
After a whole lot of trial and error, you did manage to figure it out.
We did a lot of trial and error. I have to tell you, I did an awful lot of trial and error. Is that I was 25 and starting that business, and now I'm lucky enough to have a pretty talented staff that really do know what they're doing, so try to keep me out of trouble.
Yeah. You never cross over into the buttermilk, though, do you?
Well, you know, we do make buttermilk from the butter. That is the byproduct of butter making.
Right.
And we actually don't keep the buttermilk for sale. We feed it to cows.
Oh.
We mix it in with our whey, and we feed it to young cows, and they love that. It's got protein, and it's quite palatable. And I think that if we were to try to bottle it, and we'd have to repasteurize it, and it would be an aspect of our operation that we're just not sure we want to get into. But
yeah,
awfully good.
I just got a book by Sinclair.
Mm-hmm.
Is that her name?
Diane
St. Clair, yes, from Vermont also, yeah.
All the good producers are from Vermont.
Uh-huh.
We were surprised to find out it's the highest, what was the highest incidence of drug abuse in Vermont?
I know. At least we're talking about it anyway, right?
Why? I mean, it's such a peaceful lifestyle.
We don't want to go there.
All right.
Yeah.
That's a subject for a medical.
I have another question.
That's for the governor, program. Right.
Okay, it's a medical program.
I have another question is, now, you have all these goats and you have goat milk. One of my favorite things in the world is goat milk butter.
Uh-huh.
And, but I guess I've only got it from Marienburg. Do you make that too?
You know, we don't make goat's milk butter for a couple of reasons. The goat milk is very valuable. It costs a lot to produce it, and so when we buy the milk, we're putting it all into the cheese, because if you separate the goat milk, you separate the cream from the milk,
okay,
then you've got a milk byproduct, skim goat's milk, which I don't think would make as wonderful a goat cheese without the fat. And quite honestly, we really love our butter.
I love your butter.
And I can't imagine making something and making you choose between the goat butter and the cow butter. So,
Now, how do you get the
Vermont or the bamboosh? Oh, the mascarpone.
The mascarpone.
Mm-hmm.
Where does that come in?
Well, the mascarpone is actually different from creme fraiche in that it's what we call an acidified cream. So we add, instead of a bacterial culture and actually ferment the cream, we acidify it with an acid, which could be, you know, acetic acid or citric acid.
Oh.
You could, lemon juice, anything that will coagulate that cream and make all the protein coagulate, if you will, and make the mascarpone.
I'll be darned, I never knew that.
So it's got a sweetness to it.
Yeah, it does.
So creme fraiche is a little bit nutty and got some acidity, and the mascarpone is sweet. It almost tastes like there's sugar in there, but there really is.
Tell me this. I mean, this article I read said the chefs across the country were beginning to experiment with cultured butter. Mm-hmm. Do you find that you have a chef's market increase in cultured butter?
That they are actually using the cultured butter?
Yes.
Yeah, most of our butter business is in restaurants, and it's actually been in the dining room, in the front of the house. And the way that we have positioned that is that for restaurants who serve their customers bread and butter on the table, we want them to use something that's distinctive and hope that their wait staff will explain to the restaurant patrons, this is a wonderful artisanal butter made in Vermont, and, you know, try to sort of highlight that as part of their meal and not as sort of an accessory to the meal. I think that for the kitchen, this butter is used not in all their dishes because it's costly, but they'll use it for a beurre blanc or something very specific that performs particularly well with a very high-quality butter.
I see. Yeah. But do you think, because we just had now, butter is back. Do you think that there is an expansion in the market?
Yeah, I think that people are kind of disillusioned by the trans fat, and the margarine is not the solution. And that actually consuming synthetic stuff really is not great for your body. Your body doesn't digest those things at all. And good, high-quality, flavorful butter in moderation is a great thing. And I think that we went through a period where consumers eliminated fat from their diet and have come back to find that fat has a role because it satisfies craving for food. And if it can satisfy, you know, if we can avoid cravings for sugar and carbohydrates and things by having some fat in our diet, there's a good balance there.
Sounds good, Allison. And people can order directly from your website?
They can. If they order from our website, it goes directly to Murray's Cheese Shop in New York, and they will ship it out, and they can do that at a cost that's a little bit less than what we can from here in Vermont. So hopefully that's an advantage. Yeah.
And the website is?
The website is www.vermontcreamery.com.
Right. And it's a nice, informative website, too. I think people will learn a lot just by
tons of wonderful, wonderful stuff on there. And we have a very beautiful Facebook page with lots of delicious-looking photography and lots of learning there.
Adorable goats and things.
Yeah.
Well, it's great talking to you.
Great to talk to you again, yeah.
And don't go away, because we'll be right back after a short break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
But if you think the story of 4505 meats is unusual, if you think the Vermont Creamery story is fascinating and really rather remarkable, just wait till you hear John William
Macy
talking about the world of cheese sticks.
I'm approaching this man of mystery.
You're tongue-tied. You better start again.
I'm approaching this man of mystery called John William Macy, who has the most incredible cheese sticks, cheese crisps, and sweet sticks going. Hello, John.
How are you doing? Nice to talk to you.
Well, I just can't understand. I can't get my head around the fact that you have the best cheese sticks I've ever had, and I've had plenty and plenty of them. And you're not even Southern. You're a Yank.
Well, I guess the explanation of that would probably be that, what did I know? I didn't know any better when I came upon them, or I might develop them, I guess you could say. I was interested in catering when I got out of college quite some time ago, a couple of decades anyway, and I had wanted to increase the offerings that I put out to my prospective customers and thought a cheese stick would be a good addition to the menu, and that about putting together a cheese stick the way I thought one should be done without really having any exposure to the southern style of cheese straw, which I've since come to learn is really quite different. It's a bread dough-based product. What I think of as southern cheese straws are a more of a pastry, almost a pie pastry creation. Very good right out of the oven, but they just don't have crunch and durability that ours have.
Well, is that crunch what makes yours so addictive? I mean, Peter's complaining all the time about that. He can't stop eating them. And, you know, and he's a thin man with a good willpower.
Yeah, well, I mean, I have one at 10:30 at night when I'm watching my favorite TV program. It's really terrible. I shouldn't be doing that. You're to blame for this.
Well, and I'll take that blame. The crunch is appealing, certainly, but the flavor is pretty important, too, that the one that we have a variety of products,
yeah,
of course.
Yeah, why don't you just run through the first ones were the twists, which probably are still my most favorite. The what cheeses were those, the original ones?
There's asterisks all over the place. But for the first 5 years in the marketplace to the retail trade, all that we were selling was one variety of cheese sticks. So we only had the one line of products, the sticks. And it was just the original cheddar, a combination of cheddar cheese and Asiago with a little cayenne accent. And the sourdough-based dough was the flagship product and still is our best seller. But there's some company in that line now. It's the second flavor we introduced, and that wasn't until we moved out of our tiny shop in Manhattan and came out here to New Jersey in 1990, was Romano garlic, which we recently relaunched as Garlic Romano. We thought it might do a little better just by inverting those two. And I think it's about the same, but good product. And then we have a Swiss variety with Swiss cheese and Dijon mustard called Dijon Swiss.
Did I have those? I don't remember.
No, we didn't have any of those.
They're referred to as the red box. They sell well at Christmas to the gift packs because like the color. But it's one of our lower sellers. And then we also have a cheddar scallion variety, which uses the same combination of cheeses as the flagship original cheddar, but with green scallions mixed in, variation. And then we have a Parmesan-flavored product.
I love that,
Parmesan,
yes.
Cheese. So you've had that one? I'm sure I sent you that.
Right, I had it.
Yeah.
I love it.
Notice the texture on the Parmesan, or let me ask you, did you notice that the texture on the Parmesan was a little bit different than that of the of the cheddar, say?
Yes, it reminded me a little bit of, who was it, the kitchen table bakers that do the Parmesan crisps?
Huh.
Yeah. And
interesting. Well, the textural difference for those two products that we make is that the Parmesan is made from what's called a blitz dough. It has a fairly small amount of butter chunks, hard butter, blitzed into the dough while it is being mixed, and it has the effect of a sort of a mock puff pastry.
Oh.
It just separates the little pieces of dough, blobs of dough, so that you get a flakier effect. So it's not quite as robust a crunch. And a lot of people like that. So we call it melting Parmesan, actually.
Okay.
And then you moved on to a different form factor, right? Those little sort of funky,
crisps.
Almost square things.
The crisps.
Oh, the cheese crisps. And that's one of the asterisks I had cited earlier when I said in the first 5 years it was just the cheese sticks. Actually, the cheese crisps came about while we were still in Manhattan, but we didn't sell them at retail until quite a bit later, only into food service. And they were made originally from the trimmed dough of the cheese sticks. It's a layering process that you whereby the dough is rolled out and then a cheese filling is put in the middle and the dough is folded over, rolled out again, and folded. That's where you get the layering of the dough and cheese, very similar to the way a croissant would be assembled or puff pastry. But instead of butter, it just has a lot of cheese in it. In any case, you don't want to have the edge pieces of that piece of dough have the risk of not having the requisite concentration of cheese in it, so there's some trimming that goes on. And even though our production was very modest in those days in our 600-square-foot shop on 13th Street in Manhattan. At the end of the day, at the end of the week, it mounted up to quite a bit that we were just throwing out. And it occurred to me one day, and I think somebody helped me with this. I think it was indirectly, we were selling cheese sticks to the Grand Hyatt in New York. This is the late 80s, and at the time, it was a big deal. It was the new hotel in town.
It's the one at the train station, right?
That's right. It used to be the Commodore Hotel, and Donald Trump bought it and his group and reflagged it as a Hyatt, a Grand Hyatt. And it had been there for a couple of years, and they were redoing their bar program and trying out different bar snacks, and our cheese sticks worked very well. And purchasing guy that I interfaced with, I didn't talk to the chef directly, but he says, chef's always asking, can you make something smaller? At the time, the one and only size we made was this 8-inch long stick, which is bigger than the ones that I sent to you. Those were about 6 inches long.
Yeah, 8-inch seems pretty long.
Yeah.
I could have two 8-inch ones.
It occurred to me, after making a delivery and driving back to our shop, it was just about 20 minutes, of taking the trimmed dough from the cheese sticks, sheeting that out again, and then putting another layer of cheese in the middle and following the same process, and then instead of thin strips rolled into cheese sticks, twisted cheese sticks, just baking them as little squares, cut them with a pizza knife, a rotary pizza knife, and took them back up to the guy, and he looked at me, said, the chef is going to love these. And by the time I got back to the shop, he said, I got to have 300 pounds. And of course, by that time, I was all out of scrap dough. So anyway, thus, Cheese Crisp were born.
Wow. Now then you went on. You decided that it was necessary for cheese stick lovers to have a complete tasting menu of cheese sticks. So you crossed the divide from savory to...
to the sweet, yes, indeed. And that was... I think the original impetus for that was that while we were in New York, and this was really only 5 years, but it was a formative 5 years, there had been an issue with, we were in a tenement building, which has since come down, we were the ground floor, the storefront, and whereas we had good relations for most of the tenants in the building who would come down, and the other thing we did with the leftover dough is we'd roll it up and make it into a English muffin-sized roll called cheese rolls that if you split and toast are a wonderful product. Keep your eyes peeled on our website. One of these days we might get to it. But some of the tenants took exception to how aromatic our product was and the air on the street and the entire building. They said, you know, I there's no question about where I live because of you. And some of them didn't like it, and I was concerned about it, and I thought, well, if we had a sweet product that we could make every couple of days, and we would be emitting that aroma, that might be better. But I actually didn't get around to it until we moved out to New Jersey, and the first attempt in 92 wasn't entirely successful because the texture of the dough working with a sweet filling was so entirely different than the cheese filling that I had to, took me a while to get it right. And actually, only got it right once I reintroduced cheese into the filling, not the cheddar cheese, which is very strong, but a jack cheese, just to give it some body and a little bit of flavor.
I knew there was some cheese in there. I knew there was a savory thing.
Snuck it in there.
And said, no, it's all sweet. And I said, no.
I didn't say that.
You
no.
did.
I said that it's not dead sweet, which
not,
is why I like
dead
it.
Not sweet. No, that's the difference. Now, did other people in the tenement building, were never impacted by this, right? So they didn't
unfortunately,
object.
Unfortunately, no. And again, it was really only one or two that made it, so to speak, a stink about it. And then eventually, in the last couple of months we were there, I don't know, somebody had probably complained to the New York City, let's see, they must have a DEP, yeah, Department of Environmental, but wouldn't be DEP, Department of Environmental Protection, but somebody that had jurisdiction over air quality, and they came by and they said, you're going to have to do something about this. And I said, well, you know, we're planning to move in 6 months. Kind of looked around the room and said, okay, no problem.
And you gave him a box of cheese sticks and he went away happy.
You know, I don't even remember, but it actually came with us. The issue anyway. And some years ago, we had to install a very expensive catalytic oxidizer through which we would pass the vent, the exhaust, from our ovens, and it's just neutralized. So kind of too bad, but it's good for neighbor relations.
My God, I can just imagine having that odor wafting around our kitchen.
It sticks. I mean, it's a lovely aroma, but do you want it with you 24 hours a day?
Well, I'd be eating at least 3 pounds of cheese sticks a day.
Well, let's see how long that lasts. That would be interesting. We could test that. Actually, we'll visit next time.
Well, now we know that you make them and we love them, and our listeners are sort of drooling at this point. How do they get them?
Well, it can be a little bit frustrating. It has been difficult for us to have a reliable store locator on our website. We've tried a couple of times, but it can be very difficult to keep track of that, keep it up to date, so that the information you do provide in terms of where they're available is accurate. But there is evidently a new feature that's going to be on our website soon, and by soon I think that's going to be the next 2 months or so, that there will be a good version of pop in your zip code and you'll be able to find out where it is. But they are, generally speaking, in the U.S., they're available across the land in a large, do I venture to say, a large portion of the independent specialty stores that are out there. And there are fewer of those than they used to be because the mainline supermarkets have co-opted some of that business. And in the Northeast, we're in some of the large chains. We're in the ShopRite chain system-wide in the deli department. We're in some Stop and Shop. We're in Wegmans. I mean, the long list of stores
but
where
you don't
exist.
Do internet fulfillment, though. They can't order from the website?
Yeah, and they can. That's right. We have an e-commerce site that we hope is easy to use. You just go there and it'll direct you. In fact, that's what we see most of the activity on our website is people ordering direct from us. There, I should mention that they are in and out of Costco on a rotational basis, and that's unfortunate when it's for us when it rotates out. That's sort of how Costco operates, is bringing in product for a couple of months and then they move on to something else. But what it has done is it's driven the sales on our e-commerce site because we pick up so many fans when it's featured in Southern California, for example, about twice a year. But between placements, that people will go to the website and we'll ship out directly.
Yeah, because they can't do without them, you rascal.
Yeah. Can't do without, that's right.
You must put something
and then
in
also
it.
Also expand upon the, that there's just one variety that, not the original cheese stick, but the Asiago cheese crisp, the original cheese crisp that we started in the Grand Hyatt, is what we offer at Costco, so that's our biggest seller on the
Wow.
The website.
Now, you're not in Whole Foods?
They're spotty in Whole Foods.
Spotty, okay.
It's they're in some, but not in all. It's not system wide.
Do us both a great service. Promise you'll never sell to Walmart.
Oh, okay. Well, let's see now. That's a complicated promise, but I can say it's certainly the case right now. That's kind of weak, isn't it?
It is kind of weak. So it sounds like you're a salesperson, and you can't possibly take a possible customer out of play.
Well, we just had a company meeting this morning, and we covered a number of different things. But in the review of how the company was doing, I was telling our group that from where we stand now, and we're seeing a little bit of a dip, it's been soft during the recession, or at least the back end of the recession. But I was saying, looking back several years, it's sort of, in retrospect, obvious that we should have been working hard several years ago to develop new sales, because it always takes time, and you can never have enough. But I said, remember, at the time we were overloaded. We were flooded with one round after another with Costco, and we were concerned about capacity issues. And that's a serious thing, too. But, you know, it's trying to get that balance that's the tricky thing.
Well, you're doing a great job, and I wish you a lot of luck with the Specialty Food Sophie Awards this year. I mean, hopefully we'll know pretty soon who's a finalist in those. And, yeah. And so just keep up the good. Are you doing anything new? I mean,
well, we did, I don't know if I mentioned it by name, but we had the garlic parmesan introduced in the winter show. So that's just getting out into the system now. It takes a while for a new product to gain traction. We've also introduced fairly recently it's not a new product, but it's a new package size, and I think opens up the door to the product appearing in different venues, so to speak. A single-serve two-pack with two sticks in it.
Oh, wow.
Which I just had a chocolate sweet sticks two-pack 2 hours ago because I needed something to go with that coffee. So that's good. And then I'm always messing around. There is a restaurant show that just finished up at the Javits here in New York, and I put out a couple of new things for which I got good feedback, but haven't taken the next step of trying to introduce them to have them join the line.
Well, you sound like you're having a good time, too.
I had a pretty good time, sure. Well, it's Friday after all, so, you know.
Right.
Now, when you have a little glass of something in your hand before dinner, which flavor do you prefer?
The thing I take home, which is probably what you're getting at, tends to be the standard Asiago cheese crisp. It's just the most versatile, just great for drink time, whether it's a glass of wine, a beer, or a cocktail. It's just a splendid combination. But what I'm taking home this evening is actually another box of the Cheddar Asiago and one of the items that I didn't really introduce, but I showed, let's say, at the restaurant show, which was a combination of the cheddar cheese filling, but with dried cranberries mixed in.
Wow.
And I really like both the flavor and the textural contrast with the chewy fruit in there. It's neat. They have a pretty different look, and it's really tricky not to overbake the cranberries so that they get too dark. But it's that's what I'm taking home tonight, if that answers your question.
Oh, yeah, wonderful.
I'm jealous.
Well, you're just a pleasure to talk to, John.
I wish you were my neighbor, John.
Yeah.
Hey, well, don't just come on by anytime. Where are you anyway?
In Pittsburgh.
Okay. Well, you know, I'm sure you have visits to the metropolitan area at some point.
We do.
Yeah, we'll be there for the Fancy Food Show. We'll be there
great.
For the Beard Awards.
Well, great. I mean, if you have time, just send me a note and be happy to have you come through and pay us a visit out here.
Oh, nice.
But I know it's a busy time, so
I won't be
disappointed if you don't.
Good talking to you, John.
Wonderful.
Thank you. Bye.
And we'll be back next week with more interesting stories about food, with more interesting people, with more about things to drink. Perhaps you never can tell. So you'll have to tune in next week just to find out. And until then,
bye-bye.